clergymen, are there any others that you had any golf association with or anecdotal relations?
No, I have not. I've been involved in many interreligious things, but I believed that I was involved for the wrong reasons. I was instrumental, along with Lillian Friedberg, in establishing the Conference on Religion and Race, which still exists. All of this and many other things on the food program, because there would be a priest, a minister, and I would be there as the chair of the Jewish Community Relations Council. And I thought that was wrong. If we were going to have ordained people on the other level, I not just tried, but I succeeded in getting some of our rabbis involved. So that I felt it was wrong for me to be there. My counterparts should have been the church administrators, not the priests and the ministers. One anecdote I can recall vividly. Solomon B. Friedhoff was still the senior rabbi at Rod of Sholem, and for many people in the general community, the leader of this Jewish community. Well, we were trying to establish the Conference on Religion and Race, this in the aftermath of the great 1963 conference in Chicago, which I mentioned earlier. I was very close to Dr. Friedhoff. We would chat every morning. I would walk him home to his apartment almost every day. And it was the feeling in our JCRC that if we could get the three major religious denominations involved, we'd have a conference. So it was my duty to invite Dr. Friedhoff to be one of the co-chairs. And he said, "My boy, at this stage of my life, what do I need this for?" Well, I said, "It's very important for all of us, especially for all of us as Americans." And finally said, "All right, for you, if you can get the bishop to be one of the co-chairs, I'll say yes." Well, of course, Bishop Wright.
Right.
But of course, we did get the bishop, and so late in his career, Solomon B. Friedhoff became intimately involved in social action in America. He was a man of his word, and with the chair, I'm trying to think who it was, of what is now Christian Associates, with those three, we launched a very successful local council, which still exists.
Yeah, well, that's a good anecdote. I'm glad that we found it. Although that was very good. Let's then, go to Jewish rabbis. Still staying away from Rod of Shalom. Who have you known here in Pittsburgh? You've already mentioned.
I've never talked about rabbis. Other than in positive terms. Otherwise, I've been
mute. I don't intend you to.
What?
I don't intend you to talk any otherwise.
I've known most of them who have been here. The Reform rabbis on a fairly intimate basis, and many of the others, some of the older Orthodox rabbis who liked Dr. Friedhoff, especially liked his rabbinic library, and who would study with him. By and large, I would say a decent lot, and because of their decency, we had peace and harmony rather than contention in this Jewish community. Many people couldn't understand it, but to me, that was a positive for this Jewish community, not having to waste energy, and in many instances now, we do waste energy, fighting all kinds of kashrut battles when for the larger Jewish community, there are more significant problems. Each of our denominations, and there may be four or five Jewish denominations, can be quite parochial when it comes to Jewish matters. But by and large, we can work in harmony, as we did for decades that I experienced firsthand here.
Can you think of some names specifically? Who studied with Friedhoff?
Rabbi Leifer, also of blessed memory. They liked one another very much. Friedhoff was a scholarly person, right to the end, and he would give all kinds of time to younger rabbis who wanted to study, who weren't simply passing through. But he and Rabbi Leifer would study on a near regular kind of basis.
Landis, do you remember?
Oh, I still know him, yes, Rabbi from the Margaretta Street Shul. Yeah. Seymour Cohen, I was close with Seymour Cohen when Seymour was at B'nai Israel, conservative mm-hmm. synagogue in East Liberty. He went on to Chicago mm-hmm. and assumed a major leadership role in the conservative mm-hmm. Rabbinate. But we had a friendship because when I was teaching economics at Pitt, he was teaching economics at Pitt. Mm-hmm. So we were colleagues. He was a good sense of humor, a great kibitzer, a hard worker when he wanted to work. And he did go on to what I'm sure were bigger and better things for him. He has one of the premier, unless he's just retired within the last year or two, has one of the premier conservative congregations in the great city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good story to tell. And We know that Rabbi Freehoff did, as you say, studying with...
Yes, he also with Rabbi Herman Halpern.
Yeah.
I won't go into some of his personal quirks or qualities, but he, to a great extent, was underrated in our community. He was a very scholarly type, mm-hmm. Wrote some quite significant books, but significant books don't get that much of a play in the popular press.
Mm-hmm.
And he moved Tree of Life from Oakland to Squirrel Hill, which was not a minor feat mm-hmm. to bring off.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Lichter, who was a prince of a man, everybody loved him. He was Seymour Cohen's predecessor at B'nai Israel, just a lovely, lovely man.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Shapiro, Joseph Shapiro, who was at Poalit Tzedek, was a modest man, an Orthodox rabbi. I think to a great extent our not having waves made in the community was because of Rabbi Shapiro, a devout and a good Orthodox Jew, a good leader of his congregation, and again, a decent sort.
Mm. Yeah, those are the kind of recollections which I think are most helpful.
Well, they are for me. Others who moved on, but I don't have to mention all. I'm trying to remember the one at... There was one at Beth Sholem, who then went upstate New York, who was, I don't know if it was Karp, also.
I'm trying to remember the one at Temple Sinai.
Levinson.
No.
Did you know him?
Oh, I knew
him. He helped start it.
That's correct, Rabbi Levinson.
Oh, tell me about the split when that happened.
There was no split. But Rabbi Levinson, I met too. He's still alive and in the pulpit.
Really? What city?
I'm not demeaning him. He worshipped Rabbi Freehoff. Mm-hmm. He would be here often.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Monty Syme, who has mm-hmm. the big temple, one of the two major temples in Detroit, was working on his doctorate at Pitt. Would come in to meet with Dr. Freehoff almost weekly. Many of these people, I don't want to sound egotistical, I would meet these people and be involved simply because I was at Rosh Hashanah. I didn't do a minimal job at Rosh Hashanah. I wanted to be involved and learn and do. You asked about the split. There was no split between Rosh Hashanah and Temple Sinai. There's been no split at Rosh Hashanah. There was an abortive effort during the heyday of the American Council for Judaism
mm-hmm.
to establish a council congregation in Pittsburgh. Because of Dr. Freehoff's attitudes and conciliatory attitudes, he didn't fight or anything of the sort, so people did not break away from Rosh Hashanah to start another congregation. Rather, they started their own kind of Sunday school with their non-anti-Zionist textbooks, things like that, but there was no split. Rosh Hashanah grew and grew. It was the only Reform congregation in Pittsburgh, which would include the South Hills mm-hmm. area. The congregation had grown, and the trustees felt that it had grown too large, so that towards the end of World War II, they decided to close membership. Membership mm-hmm. was closed in Rosh Hashanah except mm-hmm. for children of mm-hmm. member families. Mm-hmm. And Rosh Hashanah lent money. I mean, all of this is documented. lent money to the group organizing Temple Sinai and loaned trustees as well. Temple Sinai was organized with the best wishes and the cooperation of Rodef Shalom, so that Rodef Shalom wouldn't go up to the 3,000 family. Around that time, there were about 2,000 families in Rodef Shalom. The same situation prevailed in Mount Lebanon when a group wanted to organize a temple. Trustees weren't loaned, but a modest amount of money was loaned from Rodef Shalom to Temple Emmanuel so they could get started. These loans were fully repaid, but there has been harmony and not controversy between and among these congregations. We also offered blessings. I can't remember whether we loaned any money to Temple David as it became established in the Monroeville area, and probably no two rabbis in America have had a more wholesome collegial relationship than Rabbi Jason Edelstein of Temple David and Rabbi Walter Jacob of Temple Rodef Shalom.
Mm-hmm. That's a good remark, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are nice recollections. Something that has always mystified me, Rabbi Freehoff seemed to relish celebrating his bar mitzvah and celebrating his bar mitzvah for 50 years and more, and yet he never had any until it was all gone. I'd like to have a little insight on that.
All right, Rodef Shalom did not have any bar mitzvah service. Rodef Shalom in Pittsburgh until 1966, when Dr. Freehoff retired, went along the original reform lines that the ceremony should be a group ceremony for all the children to be confirmed together. They'll reaffirm the vows of accepting Torah. And so we did not have bar mitzvah. We knew through the years many of our families would belong to other congregations, not for bat mitzvah, so their sons might become a bar mitzvah at B'nai Israel or Tree of Life or Beth Shalom. Shalom B. Freehoff was a wise man. He did virtually nothing impulsively, and he didn't like to hold out or to be nasty for the sake of holding out. He was a great compromiser. I always looked upon that as one of his most positive attributes, that he could compromise things, not out of weakness, but out of getting both parties to continue to work together. His rationale was he was a bar mitzvah. He never denied anything like that. And what he said, I think with less vigor towards the end, was if we were to have bar mitzvah preparation at Rodef Shalom, such as the preparation that he had, he would countenance the ceremony here. But he said when he would be places and see, well, I don't want to use demeaning language, what would suffice for a bar mitzvah ceremony or how little the child actually knew, he thought it was something of a travesty. So he maintained that position to the end, I would say against overwhelming odds, because had there been a plebiscite, my guess is 2/3 to 3/4 of the congregation would say, let's have the ceremony. If I may, parenthetically, during those years, I was, and still am, a loyal team player. I believe that the rabbi is the voice of the congregation, not the executive secretary, so that I would be accosted at every social function as though I was setting the policy, and I remained true to Shalom B. Freehoff. I gave his justification for not having bar mitzvah. I was, as I indicated much earlier to you, I was a bar mitzvah at age 13 in 1938. So I was asked, what would I do with my children? And it was simple. If Temple has the ceremony, my children will be bar mitzvah. If not, they're not going to go somewhere else. It was one of the weakest points in my life, having to be consistent for him. He was not accosted. He was not attacked. I had to bear the brunt of that. In 1966, when Rabbi Walter Jacob succeeded Solomon B. Freehoff, almost overnight, we instituted the ceremony. And I will say that once we instituted it, Solomon B. Freehoff did not boycott it. He came every Shabbos. He sat on the bima, and he complimented Rabbi Jacob, saying it's being very well done. He thinks it's a very good thing for the children. But during his tenure, I indicated why he didn't want to have it. There were some members of the congregation who would not come. These are regular Sabbath worshipers who would come week in and week out. When we were going to have a bar mitzvah, they didn't come on that Saturday. We had one who will remain nameless because she's still alive and healthy, would still come on Saturday, but as the child would go up to the Torah, she would leave the sanctuary. She would time it well so that when that part of the service was over, she would come in. Our service was not like many. It was not a bar mitzvah service. We had the regular Sabbath service. We had many regular worshipers, and the service was a part of the larger service. Mm-hmm. We did not go overboard, turning it in, as it had been turned over in many places, just to the family and the child.
Thanks for that. I knew I wanted the official line here, and your feeling about it. Doesn't the fact that people accosted you and not Freehoff say something about his pastoral relationships? And I'd like you to comment further on this.
The answer is yes, but part of that was my role. I play a similar role with Dr. Jacob. Part of it may be me, that I have been involved. I was a member of Rod of Shalom before I worked at Rod of Shalom. I was a member, and I knew people, and I kept knowing more and more people, and I would be at any and all activities that this congregation had. So I'm just guessing that people were more comfortable talking to me.
You were a pastoral surrogate.
That's exactly what I was. To a great extent, I was that for Rabbi Jacob, because people knew that I had an easy relationship. It was easy to work with Solomon Freehoff, easy to work with Walter Jacob, in that there were no airs, no fears.
Easy for whom?
For me.
Yes, for you.
For me. I wasn't trying to take over their job. There was no jealousies and no pettinesses. As I think I told you earlier, we didn't have staff meetings. Freehoff would come in the morning and just shout out, "Boys," and whether it was an assistant rabbi, associate rabbis, or me, we would sit down and we would talk. And I would be very candid with him that I was at this party, which doesn't interest you, doctor, but this is what I heard from this, that. And I think people realized early on that to a great extent I was his eyes and ears, and that what they would tell me would go to him, that I didn't turn deaf ears. He might not have acted instantly, but that's a role that I played. I like the way you put it, Howard, the surrogate. That is correct. I never assumed that I was the rabbi, and I refused to assume rabbinic functions, even though I might have. That is, I had the qualities, the abilities, but I consciously resisted that so that there'd be no mistaking. In fact, I may quote myself, when we have a new member at breakfast and I'm called on for a few comments, people don't know, what's an executive secretary of a congregation do? So I said, I will state it for you succinctly, and as you are members for years, you can flesh it out. But as executive secretary, I have a function. The rabbis do all the godly, and I do all the ungodly. And people seem to understand it because I have understood it.
Yes, very nicely put. In effect, the rabbi has the sancta,
right,
and you have the clerical office.
Well, I enable them,
yes,
to perform their true functions better.
True. And yet, pastoral work has always been considered holy work in Judaism and elsewhere.
Freehoff would not perform it.
I know that. That's why I'm probing.
I heard, and I have every reason to believe, since people were alive, when he was brought to Pittsburgh from Chicago, he had a substantial congregation in Chicago. This congregation, Rod of Shalom, very badly wanted him to come here. And he set certain limitations. I believe it was to Marcus Aaron,
yes,
who was our president, that he told him he's not a pastoral rabbi,
that's right,
that he does not make hospital visits, that he considers mm-hmm. the pulpit to be most significant, so that he rarely would make hospital calls. I would receive a lot of heat from that too, mm-hmm. which I didn't pass on to him. You have your father or your aged mother in the hospital, and they're there for a few months, and every other rabbi in the community visits, and priests come and visit, and the rabbi of Rodef Sholem doesn't come and visit. It's hard to pacify those people or assuage whatever those feelings are. Nonetheless, he had assistants, and they would make the calls. They would do some of the pastoral calls. What he said, I'm telling you, I was so close to him for so long, people thought we had a father and son relationship. I said, that's not correct. I had a father, I had a very, very good father, and my father and I had a father and son relationship. That he was a generation and a half older than I was didn't mean much. It was so easy to live and to be with him, so scintillating to be with him, that we did develop a friendship. I think he would have said, too, that I wasn't his son, but that I was a good colleague and a friend. And what he would say was that the pastoral aspect of the rabbinate was an American phenomenon, that European rabbis didn't visit everybody and anybody, maybe to get some support or a meal, but that was the influence of American Christianity. We live in an overwhelming Christian environment. We see our Christian neighbors visited by their priests and by their ministers, and so jealously we want the same kind of attention. At this stage in 1990, I'm sure most Jews would say that that's one of the major functions of a rabbi. And what Freyhoff would say is that if the rabbis did less of that and spent more time studying Torah and reading books, they'd probably be better rabbis. But that is how he justified it. Again, not on meanness, not that there wasn't any time in the world, but that his time could be better spent. And as he said, a Jew just exits this world. A Roman Catholic needs a priest there for extreme unction, but Jews can leave the world all by themselves. They don't need rabbinic guidance.
Then he never visited the homes of the deceased, right?
No, he would do some of that. That's different.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah. If he would officiate at a funeral, he would try to make a call there, yes.
Did he treat his friends any differently than the general population?
Well, he did not have many friends in the sense that you and I are talking. Things so much wells up in my mind when I think of him. He would tell his assistants, young assistants, you don't tell dirty jokes. You may hear them, but don't tell them, no matter, because it puts you on a totally different level with your congregants. And when they then want to look up to you, because they have to, for their own personal reasons, it's difficult for them to do it. It's not that he was a stodge. He knew what he was doing and why he was doing it. Did not have what I would call many friends. He did not. But for the lawyers, physicians who attended him, they would be treated differently. But he stated that even when he retired. And he retired in 66. He was hale and hearty and lived from 1966 until this year. But he told me it was always prefaced by, my boy, I am now retired. Walter Jacob is the senior rabbi, and you have to tell people when they call you that he is the senior rabbi. A physician who has attended me, or these few lawyers, if they ask, I would still perform whatever life cycle functions. And he was consistent in that. It had nothing to do with the wealth of a congregant or anything of the sort. Those few who were his friends. And there were some. E.B. Strasburger, Louis Kaplan, whom I mentioned early. Many of them are of a generation which died in their time. Sollenby Freyhoff outlived his generation by more than, so that I had a scant acquaintanceship with those. So that by the time I was close to him, most of those who were his friends were gone.
I'd like to ask another follow-on question, as long as we're talking about Rabbi Freyhoff. He did responsa to such an extent that it must have been the fascination of his life.
It was. Oh, responsa, Jewish legal letters.
Jewish legal.
Oh, that's correct. One of his favorite teachers, Lauterbach, at Hebrew Union College, started it within the Reform movement. Freehoff built an unbelievably good library of responsa, which included several incunabula right off the first printing press. He contributed most of that to the Hebrew Union College, and they have the Freehoff responsa library. Some others went to the Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem. It was his feeling, as difficult as it was, he tried to express this feeling of maintaining a Jewish attitude towards halacha, towards the law, and at the same time being modern people. His great love of reform was attempting to solve the problem of Jewish tradition and modernity. He wanted us to be within the modern world and at the same time not throw out everything that was tradition within Jewish life. It was the great love of his life. We must have 12, 14 volumes of his Jewish legal letters. Anecdotally, towards the end of his career, well, he would bounce questions off me. My boy, I got this interesting question this morning. What do you think? Well, I became pretty good at this intuitively. Well, he said, you know, you're right, but how do you know? I said, I don't know. My intuition tells me within Jewish life, blood, when it was a question where blood mattered, you could always tell blood. So the answer's got to be along these lines. I don't know which rabbi in which century had what to say, but I would guess that 49 times out of 50, he would say, boy, you're getting very good at this. I would also be playful with him. I don't know if I mentioned this. I would ask some questions, some quite serious because of my work at the congregation, and some playful. One question which I asked him, if a man wears a toupee, does he then have to wear a yarmulke? Well, he giggled and said he would look it up. And he came back and said, within strict, narrow halacha, if you're wearing a toupee, you're wearing a head covering. That suffices. But since other people will think that you're bareheaded, you owe it to society to wear a yarmulke on top. He told me a cardinal principle of his in paskening shilas, as they put it, or answering the questions, that his attitude was to go, and he had a mind like a computer. Some of us even asked him to help some of the early computer people put the response of the whole literature, a group in Jerusalem was working on this, to yes. put it on a computer. And he said, no, in the tradition, certain rabbis have the mental apparatus he had it to remember hundreds of millions of facts and know where to look. But the difference in style, he said, was when he received a question as a liberal rabbi, using the law, using all the precedents, he would try to find a way to say yes. And the traditional rabbis, using all of the same sources, would try to find a way to say no. It's the way we can look at our Supreme Court today. The question comes to our Supreme Court. Each of the justices who's going to render an opinion is going to have to base it on the law and involve, well, as we know, we're hopeful with what Souter will bring to the court, but there are those who want to say yes and there are those who want to say no. He always inclined towards yes.
Yes, that's true. I've read about 6 or 8 of his books, so I happen to agree with that, but I do recall one. Must have been the 1974 book, or thereabout. He said the homosexuality continues to be an abomination according to Jewish law. I don't think he ever changed.
That's correct. He never, well, public, he might want to call it an abomination, but he still felt that the emphasis is being placed on all of that was unnecessary. See, what he would say from his vast readings, that it's not just what is there, but what he would find interesting is what wasn't ever mentioned. And he said in all of the tradition there just wasn't anything in the letters, which had to mean something.
Mm-hmm. What about...
But he did not modify. No, he did
he never modified.
No, he still felt it was wrong. Certain things, they would come to him, homosexuals, at the end of a service when people would kiss, that it's, so he said, you don't have to kiss. Everybody doesn't kiss at the end of a worship service. And you don't need separate congregations That's necessarily. Right. I mean, whatever it is, it is. Mm-hmm. He
was very opposed to separate congregations.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Specifically, that's what that 74 response was about, as I recall.
My question was, then evidently he certainly couldn't support birth control.
No. He could. Oh, yes. Oh, there's a great deal in the literature.
Yes.
Whether the mother's endangered and this and that.
That's a totally different ballgame.
Right. He wouldn't have gone out to make speeches, but there he could, for a variety of reasons, and he would base it on halacha, not just his opinion off the top of his head.
Mm-hmm. I can't help thinking of Freehoff, Rabbi Freehoff, asking a little bit about Lillian.
Well, Lillian is still with us.
Yes.
Dr. Jacob invited a few of us to break the fast Yom Kippur night, and Mrs. Freehoff was there, Lillian Freehoff.
Where does she live?
She still lives in the apartment on Craig Street. They've always lived in an apartment.
Park Plaza.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And before that, until Pitt took it over for the med students, up the street, the Ruskin. They lived in the Ruskin, had a very nice apartment there. It was mostly a library. You had to visit his apartment to believe it. Books were everywhere, and mostly halachic responsive books. She is a fine lady. He would push her, and then she didn't need any pushing. She has published a significant number of books on a great variety of themes. She did children's books, which were published by our movement, which were in use to recent times. She published a book on ethics for children, a very good book. I'm sure some of our temples still use it. With my predecessor's life, with Lottie Banman, they did a book on table decorations, floral decorations for tables for the various holidays of our Jewish year.